Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Wild Tales podcast. My name is Jason Fox, and on this podcast, I'm going to be speaking to some inspirational people about their lives and adventures, and looking at issues like resilience and the benefits of hitting the great outdoors. The podcast is presented by the Book of Man and supported by Talisker, the single malt whiskey made by the sea. My guest today is Aldo Kane. He's a former Royal Marine Commando sniper, an explorer, a TV presenter, a world record rower, and quite a bit of this has been with me. Over at Talisker, we talk about his formative experiences as an adventure-loving kid, experiences like jumping into an erupting volcano and living without daylight for 10 days, and discuss fear and how you can handle it. I hope you enjoy. Right, okay, so, mate, it feels a bit weird being sat opposite your best mate with a microphone plonked in front of us both, but this is the podcast, and I don't know, it's just weird, isn't it? Well, but I tell you what, just before you start rabbiting on, this is probably an opportunity that we never take. We talk as best mates, but we don't really talk about each other, as in proper, seriously posed questions.
We don't ask each other how we're feeling, do you mean?
No, we do that.
We do that.
But
and we drink whiskey.
Okay, so we're doing half of it. But anyway, let's start so people get to know the real Aldo Kane at the beginning. Growing up as a kid, mate, you're a bit of an adventurer now. You've done quite a lot. Have you always had that adventurous streak?
I grew up in Ayrshire, Coenning, with my twin brother, who's in the Marines with us. Sister, two younger brothers as well. So we were kind of, dad was in the scouts and forced us sort of into the scouts and we were in the cadets. So I guess you could say we were kind of outdoorsy. Wasn't also a lot going on up there for someone that was non-academic.
Non-academic. So yeah, go, expand. Did you get out? I mean, you're living in Scotland. It's an amazing part of the world. It's got great scenery, great outdoors. Did you get in and amongst it?
Yeah, well, I mean, we both joined up at 16, right? So it was the perfect stomping ground for training to get into the Marines. You know, you were in Luton, which probably wasn't the perfect stomping ground for getting into the Marines, or might have been one way or another, but so for Ross and I, my twin, you know, we had Aaron on the doorstep, we had Glencoe on the doorstep, so we were out almost every weekend climbing, yomping around. In fact, we've got a picture of Ross and I on the Commando Memorial when we were like four. Dad took us up there. So really?
How old's the Commando Memorial? I thought it was new.
No, I mean, it's obviously older than 41 years. So I've, you know, as a stomping ground, Scotland is, you know, as a proving ground as well for then doing something like joining the Corps at a young age, it's quite good. And you grow up kind of resilient, don't you? You know, you're in the outdoors, you're not sat in playing computer games, so
they didn't exist then, all you're no, about.
Yeah, fair point. I reckon, it was a good outdoor sort of education upbringing. And weirdly, all the stuff that I learned in scouts, in cadets, I remember when you're going through Limston and they're teaching you about navigation map reading, I was like, I've got this down already. Not to the extent that I needed to, but you know, you have an idea about, you know, how to navigate and that sort of thing. So
did you have any I mean, obviously it's me now, but did you have anyone that you looked up to when you were young?
Dick. All right. Yeah, no, it's you. Yeah, I suppose when I was, I don't know, when I was growing up, I was quite, I didn't really do much reading until I left the Corps, until I left the Marines. I was aware of Explorers and Shackleton and you know, Scott and these guys that were doing some fairly big stuff. But I think more my people who I looked up to were probably people like my dad, people at the, you know, leaders at the cadets and scouts, which were you know, close by, humble sort of normal people that are just getting on with some graft. Now, obviously, now I'm, you know, read a bit more, and I'm starting to read about like Marcus Aurelius and people like that, and the way that they are thinking about the world 2,000 years ago is, you know, it's super pertinent now. So Marcus Aurelius and Jason Fox, really.
You're trying to come across as an educated kind of mind.
Yeah.
I know otherwise. What did? How did you find? I'm interested to talk about this actually, because how did you find recruit training when you first turned up? And I'll tell you how I found it.
You know, you join at 16, so you go from being a paper boy to in the Corps, and at 16 you're working with loads of old dudes that are like 30, 26. But at that time, you know, 16, you're sort of like sharing a bed space with a guy who's, you know, could be 24, 25, he's had a career in some other type of job, and so it's daunting. You remember when you go into induction and there's 50 lads in there, and it's all open bed spaces.
Induction is the first phase of recruit training in the Royal Marines.
It's where they teach you to sort of like wash your private parts and do press-ups and how to iron bed blocks and all that sort of discipline, basically. But you
not
know,
one after the other.
But you know what it's like, and you go in there and it's daunting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you're sort of at 16. I look at 16-year-olds now and I think, how did I do it? How did you do it? But again, you know, it's daunting. There's, you know, lads who are much, much older, stronger, fitter, harder than me at that point. And they're proper men at that point. I still felt like, you know, I still felt like I was a boy.
You still look like a boy. No, but I think the thing with me is that whole thing was a blur. It was like, I made it through induction by the skin of my teeth, and I was an absolute bag of shit.
Yeah.
I couldn't.
Bet your old man was fredders with that.
Yeah. Well, no, well, you can't. I mean, what were you, because I was absolutely rubbish at my admin, as in like washing clothes, ironing. That's what really, really stung me. Did you find that easy?
Because we're, you know, I'm the eldest of five, or my twin and I. So we got kind of abandoned almost immediately as soon as my sister was born. So we were sort of like having to iron and do all that stuff. So I kind of already felt like I was all right with that stuff. What I did struggle with was probably just like the level of exercise. You know, I certainly didn't feel like my body was ready for that sort of a smashing at 16. And just, you know, just spending time with 50 men, having come from, you know, a background, you know, I'd never spent any time with any other grown men other than my old man, really.
Yeah, fair point. Just to inform people of what the fitness was, initially when you turn up, you do what they called then, I don't know whether it is now, but it was called IMF, Initial Military Fitness, which is basically Swedish PT. Now, if you watch it, you think that looks easy. You're just like making shapes with your body and then doing the odd press up and a pull up. It is, it's horrendous, isn't it?
Yeah,
hang out.
If you imagine you're just like touching your shoulders or spinning, I can't remember the moves, but like you're doing that, what, once, twice a day, and then you're doing it every day. But this is the whole getting you to start being disciplined, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's about teaching you about, you know, following instructions. It's teaching you all the basics that later on, you know, even now in my work, there's probably stuff that I rely on that came from induction.
Yeah, yeah.
Same as you, like, I hate seeing an Irish pennant on a shirt or a button.
That's a bit of loose thread hanging from some clothing that doesn't belong there. Not Aldo's arms. Just the one I've got to tell this story about. So there was the one thing that I can remember about IMF, Initial Military Fitness, was you also have to do vaulting I don't know. I have no idea why, but they get you vaulting over the old boxes. And there was one young guy, I can't remember his name, he was in my troop. He's, I say young, he was older than me, but, you know, he's a young man. And he, obviously, you run about, what, 20 yards before you then jump and vault over the box. And he basically just forgot to jump and ran into the horse. And I felt really sorry for him because he ended up having to leave because he hit it that hard that it twisted his balls, which can be mega dangerous. It's not a laughing matter, but I suppose it is now, but I feel sorry for him because if he'd just remembered to jump, he could have had a great career in the Marines.
I don't know, like that initial period, you know, 16, join the Marines, go down there. You know, I was loving it. There was loads of times, like in week two and week three or whatever of the 7 month course, where you're like, I'm in the Marines, I'm up, you know, I'm up on Woodbury Common, I'm, you know, I'm doing this exercise, and you're just like learning. I could not get enough of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm, as with everything I do, I'm, you know, at best, average at most things I do, and I was literally scraping through with, you know, the skin of my teeth,
yeah,
pretty much the whole way. You know, it's pretty much the story of my life. It's just...
I would suggest that's probably the same for most people. I don't think, I would find it difficult to believe someone who said that they breezed any form of recruit training.
And it's just that constant, I mean, that recruit training is, you know, you're getting bombarded with learning about stuff. Also, you know, I've moved to England from Scotland pretty much on my own. I was supposed to be joining with Ross, and he then stayed on school to do his, like, A-levels.
Ross is Aldo's twin brother.
Twin, yeah. And so I ended up going down on my own, and, I do remember feeling incredibly excited but mega lonely.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a weird thing. You end up, I mean, now that's why you've got so many things like military fitness, boot camps, all the rest of it, because you have that camaraderie. But I guess the first few weeks, aren't they? They're pretty lonely, testing times, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, it is. I can remember feeling really lonely, even though you live in a dormitory full of 50 guys in the beginning, but you are alone.
Yeah.
And you're not yet bonded, and you're trying to work out who's worth bonding with, because you don't know whether they're going to be there the next day. But, I mean, you just said that you enjoyed it totally, and you embraced the whole thing, and then you mentioned Woodbury Common, which is one of the training areas, but I can't believe for a second that you embraced gorse.
No!
There's a plant on this planet, and it's in abundance on Woodbury Common. It's called gorse, and you have to crawl through it.
Sharp spikes. And it's also, isn't it also, because you have Woodbury rash from doing, you know, any bootnecks listening to this will know about Woodbury rash, and it's a sort of a rash you get in your legs and any part that touches the gorse because of the chemicals doing testing?
Yeah, apparently it was used back in the Second World War as a chemical testing ground, and it's still in the earth, apparently. So if you're crawling through the gorse and it pricks your skin, then there's a chance that you get a sort of infection from it. I had wood, they call it, depending on where in the body is depending on what it's called, so I had Woodbury elbow. It was in my arse. No, it was in my elbow, and obviously it gets really infected, and there's a chance you could get seriously injured from it. So it's something to worry about when you're up on the Woodbury Common, mate. You finished training, and for me it was an amazing feeling, but again a bit of an anticlimax when you sort of like sat down and thought about it, because then you join a Royal Marines commando unit.
And you're back to the bottom of the pile again.
You are literally, you think you're the dog's obvious, and then you find yourself.
I tell you a funny story about, so when I passed out, I don't know if I've told you this before, when I passed out, we you get drafted 40 commando, that's where I was heading, and so it's like turn up on Tuesday, whenever the draft was. And
it's Tuesday, yeah.
Tuesday, yeah. So I turn up, have like a week off or something after passing out, turn up at 40 commando, and the guard room corporal was like, so I turn up there with my bags, and he's like, what's your name? And I'm like, recruit Kane. I mean, Marine Kane. He goes down his list and he's like, it says here you've been given leave. It says here you can, you're on leave, mate. Enjoy. So I was like, bollocks, I've just got all my way up to Taunton, about 200 quid a month or something, back in the day. So I was like, fine, went back down to the train station, pegged it up to Glasgow, up there that night, next day,
phone call from my sergeant major at the time, who was in Alpha Company, and he was like, "What the fuck are you doing at home?" It's like, I've been sent home. The corporal, I've been told I'm on leave for another week. Anyway, turns out I was in the process of getting nailed for being adrift, AWOL, whatever you want to call it.
Well, so what happened?
So he just got me on a bite. He just sent me home.
So a bite is, for anyone that doesn't know, is a wind up.
Yeah,
for want of a bit.
So he just sent me home. So I spent my first 2 days in the commando unit, in 40 commando, coming from the lofty heights of passing, you know, and getting your green lid and all that stuff, was cleaning out a thing called a donkey bath, which is Norton Manor's got this old sort of stately home, and it has a donkey bath, which is basically, as I said, you know, they take the donkey in and wash it, but it's made of these individual stones, and it was full of, I don't know, 50 years worth of leaves and dirt. And so my first 2 days being a Royal Marine commando was digging out a donkey bath and cleaning in between the stones with a toothbrush.
I'd just like to say that was how his career remained. There are some, you get very bored when you're in the Marines, and there's some funny games that you play. I remember one that you told me about was run around.
That's
it's where people get their own possessions will be confiscated, be it a bottle of shower gel or a toothbrush or a boot. And then everyone will gather in the TV room, and the person controlling the game will go shout out an item, and everyone has to go and run and get that item. And the person that hasn't got it, obviously, it's been hidden, and he gets into trouble. Anyway. So, if we talk about the laughs of first joining the Royal Marine Commando unit, but it is a serious job.
Yep.
It does entail you going away to dangerous places. Can you, I mean, that's probably, I would suggest I'm right in saying that the Marines exposed me to some pretty hairy experiences, or you go to dangerous environments, dangerous countries. Can you tell us a bit about your experiences with that?
So I, in the time that I was in, so I didn't go to Afghanistan. So everything that I have seen and done has been pre-Afghanistan. It was Iraq in 2003, operationally, or Northern Ireland back in the day. So I don't have a huge amount of stories and things to pull, I guess, to pull from on that. But I do remember small incidences where I've just thought, what the hell am I doing? Like, how the hell have I ended up being like this? And or being in this situation? And I then start to realize that after almost 10 years of being in, that's actually why you joined the Marines in the first place, is, you know, you're a soldier. All the stuff you do on the range, pulling a trigger, training, sniper course, everything is about being a soldier. It's about going to war, and it's about fighting. And I suppose up until that point, it didn't really sort of, you don't really think about it, do you? Like, no. And we, that first 10 years that we were in was fairly relaxed time, wasn't it? You know, we did like Northern Ireland, and we did a few other bits and bobs, but there was a lot of exercises, there was a lot of training.
Yeah.
So I think I probably just got out before it all started going.
To add to what Aldo's just said, my first, you know, 9-10 years in the Marines, I didn't really do anything. I obviously did a lot, but I didn't see any operational, I didn't take part in any operational deployment. I didn't go to Ireland. I didn't go to Kosovo. You know, all those things. And I was like, hang on a minute. It was by circumstance that I was at a unit that didn't go, and then I'd get drafted, and then that unit wouldn't go somewhere, and I felt like I was missing out to begin with. But you know, I did miss out on a few things. But I think what happens in that, whilst you're still in that process, even though I wasn't doing it for real. I was training all the time, and you're training to be a soldier. You know, you go on exercises, you're getting dirty, you're running down cliffs.
You're kind of training resilience.
I think even as a young lad, you are subconsciously in your mind sort of preparing yourself to get amongst some serious stuff. And I think that's why when you end up doing it, it doesn't seem to, you're a bit like, whoa, but then.
And also it doesn't seem real at the time, you know, and like I say, you know, I've done next to nothing compared to what the boys have been doing over the last 15 years. But it certainly, and we've been in a few situations since then where I felt the same, like narcos or whatever, where you just think, how did I end up here? But that, you know, it was a decision I wanted. I joined the Marines at 16, as you did, straight from school. You know, that I feel slightly strange now thinking back to, did I actually think that you might ever have to be in a situation where you might have to shoot at someone, kill someone, or be shot at and killed?
Mm.
I genuinely don't think it crossed my mind for the first little bit of time.
Probably a better way to be, to conduct that career anyway, I'd say.
Like ignorant in a way, probably ignorant, where it was more about the opportunities that it could give you out with the fighting bit, which is very different to what, you know, people's experiences are now of, you know, the last 15 years.
Yeah. We've spoken about, you know, your childhood, moving into the Marines, whilst in the Marines. Also, whilst we were in the Marines, we became reconnaissance leaders. Which means we're experts in reconnaissance.
No.
Whatever.
Not reconnaissance.
Was that, doing that course and being in a reconnaissance troop in the Royal Marines, you're exposed to a lot of mountain work, climbing, use ropes. Is that what, did that spark your interest in what essentially the stuff that you do now?
So, yeah, I guess like the stuff I do now is outdoorsy, expeditiony stuff. And really, like, if I'm being totally honest, you know, I can't keep saying that I'm an ex-Marine, you know, an ex-Royal Marine sniper, you know, that was yonks ago. I'd probably get banged out in a pub by someone who's like, mate, get a life, that was 20 years ago. But, you know, when you, the recce stuff, like recce leader, climbing, you know, cliff assaults, and I was working with people like Bill that you know, who are like uber professional, who, for me, that was like the pinnacle. If you can, as a two-man or a four-man team, lead people in to do a job, like that appealed to me, sneaking about, sort of OPs, rope work.
Climbing. OPs and observation position.
Yeah, like all the sort of stealthy stuff, and which ultimately pushed me towards sort of doing the sniper course. And I just thought, like, you know, that to me was Gucci, which
Gucci means cool.
That was, you know, yeah, forget how much terminology we've got rattling around here. It's like a foreign language. But, you know, that to me, you know, doing mountain training, that ability to put something really heavy on your back, carry a rifle, and then just go straight up, you know, straight up a mountain, you know, and or into technical rope work or cliff assaults or any of that sort of stuff, really did appeal. And I guess, like, if I'm looking at all the stuff I'm doing now, I remember most of the bits and bobs that I started in were probably in recce troop. It was being inspired by, you know, the mountain leaders, by the PWs, by, you know, that ability to be completely self-sufficient. And subsequently, since I've been, you know, like rigging ropes out on my own for 3 days inside an active volcano, like that, you know, although not directly relatable to that type of job, it's similar to where you're going out and rigging a cliff with ropes for other lads to come up, and there's just two of you doing it. And, you know, that's what I like. And it does seem very similar to what I'm doing now.
Right, before we move away from the military side of things, because it can get a bit boring, I just want to backtrack there and explain to people about an observation position, because Aldo said, yeah, it's all that stuff that's cool that he likes. An observation position requires a team of guys to dig a hole in the ground, make it hidden, get in that hole and live there. I mean, there's nothing cool about that. And you also, at the same time, so you don't get compromised, you have to go to the toilet in cling film and carry it out. So, yeah, I think he needs to, you know, maybe revisit that thought. And,
like,
and
I say, I love that. I'm still doing it now at home, though,
mate. So, you've been in some situations in the Marines. You've put yourself, or you've challenged yourself, and you've done well with regard to that career. What's the most, moving outside of that now, and trying to concentrate on everything that you do now, before we dig into it, what's the most challenging environment that you've had to operate in
post-military career? Military, yeah. That's a good one. I think that the hardest environment that I've ever worked in, and actually I've got everything to thank the Marines for, being in the Marines for, is jungle. I've always found that if you can operate in the jungle, you can pretty much operate anywhere. So, you know what it's like in the Corps,
you got to have a rifle, you got, you know, you're looking after all your admin, and you're then doing a job.
The core is the Royal Marines.
Royal Marines. And you've also got to do a job. So galloping crotch frot, you know, you know, you got to look after that and admin it. You got to look after your feet. There's like so many things that you've got to look after that if you just don't do anything, if you mark time with admin or hygiene, then you're coming out the field, you're getting casivac. So I think the jungle is the hardest environment that I've operated in, and everything that you learn in the jungle about, you know what it's like, you know where all your kit is exactly, in your webbing or in your rucksack, how to put up, you can put up your hammock in the dark, you can take it down in the dark, your admin is just squared. And so I think that's the hardest, and I think it's the one that I prefer the most.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there. It's sort of the one that sets the level of what you need to be at to then, if you can do it there, you can do it anywhere. And basically operating and working in any environment, it is about the basic boring stuff done well.
Yeah.
Like washing yourself. And in the jungle, it's so humid, it's so wet that everything starts to rot if you don't look after it. And also you've got, every single animal in the jungle is hell-bent on trying to kill you. And that goes for the plants as well. There's just, everything just is designed to destroy humans.
Yeah, if you're not actively looking out for yourself, then you're going to come unstuck. The interesting thing about that is that it's, you know, in all the situations I've been in, it's never a big thing that happens that gets someone taken out of the jungle, for example. It's all the collections of little things, not changing socks, not sticking rigidly to wet dry routine, getting all their kit wet on day one, by not doing the small bits of basics, you end up with someone that's eventually going to be a liability, you know, on the expedition or, you know, on the patrol, I guess.
Exactly. My thoughts, exactly.
What he said.
Right, what he said, yeah. We've done a lot of stuff together outside of our
relationship.
Outside of our relationship. We've done a lot of stuff together. However, we're now going to start talking about, we did row the Atlantic. We set the world record for the first team to row from mainland Europe to mainland South America. Let's talk about that.
From our perspective, we were a four-man team, weren't we, at the start? Matt and Ross and whatever sort of, at that time we were just going to do the Talisker row. We were going to do the Talisker row, and they didn't have a category for five, so we started talking to you about, should we get you involved in, because at that time, I mean, you were needing out and needing space and clear your head, weren't you? So we were kind of like, right, we'll get the five of us in this boat, even though none of us had done any rowing. You had definitely done the most out of everyone.
Rowing?
Well, just being on the water, really. Right. Floating. but there wasn't a category for five in that race, so we kind of had to go back to the drawing board, and we were sort of like, right, well, you know, it's 2016, wasn't it? 2015. What is it that we can do that, you know, people haven't done before, or, you know, that was new, potentially new to us as well. Adventures about, you know, might not be new to you, but if it's new to me, it's still good to do. So, yeah, I guess we, you know, Matt Bennett, who's the boss of the boat, put the team together, and then that was it. We were, you know, for about a year and a half with the lead up to it, we did lots of team building at Glastonbury, and none of it involving getting in a boat, and none of it involving rowing. So we, by the time it sort of came round, I had been putting off, I had been so busy on expedition and sort of working that I hadn't actually been in the boat. And Matt, the boss, he was like, I'll do you. Are you taking this seriously? You're not taking it seriously. He was going to bin me off the team. I had to plead and beg to stay, didn't I? To stay in the team, because he was like, you're not putting in the effort. And that was it, you know, Team Essence. You know, you've got me, you, Ross Johnson, who's an ex-Marine, Ollie Bailey and Matt Bennett, sort of both bankers, city workers, and actually Matt. But the way that we did it, we put it together, Matt and funded pretty much most of it, the boat and things, got that all in the water. Then we did loads of fundraising out with that for the NSPCC. And yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I'm
sort of most proud of in a way, because it wasn't work. It was, you know, it was five mates that have decided to go and test themselves in something that none of us had any experience in.
No, we branded ourselves the rogues of ocean rowing because we hated it and didn't really enjoy being on the boat. We just wanted to get it done. And actually, I sometimes forget that we did that.
Yeah.
It goes out of my head.
You have to look at what you've done for a job. And the bits and bobs that I do for a job is that we are experiencing lots of new things all the time. And I often get worried that I'm not remembering things, and it's because I'm jumping from one job to the next. But we, you know, without jumping the gun, we got back from the row and you were straight into filming again. And I went off on another expedition almost immediately to West Papua. So it was like we're on to the next thing already. But yeah, the row is one of the most, it's one of the coolest things I think I've ever done. It was there's nothing like being in a boat in the middle of an ocean with Tim Peake as the closest person to you in space.
So Tim Peake was on the International Space Station, and we'd worked out that when we're in the middle of the ocean, the closest person, next person to us was actually in space, because he was only like 25 miles up or whatever it is, you know. But so that's quite a cool little stat to find out. We tweeted him and he tweeted us back, and it was...
He's the closest person to us. But so effectively, five mates in a pub over whiskey go, let's roll the Atlantic, let's do something that no one's ever done before. Let's go from mainland Europe to mainland South America, Portugal to Venezuela. Cool, not much experience, jump in the boats, do it. I can definitely say that it's some of it's incredibly boring, and then there are other minutes which are incredibly funny, and there are other minutes which are terrifying, like capsize, or there's loads of funny stories. We set off and Ross Johnson, who was in charge of tea and coffee, so we'd all been out the night before we set off, and then we get back to the boat in the morning. We're setting off, and that's the last time that we're going to see land for 2 months, or however long it's going to take. And so you're rowing out, aren't you? And then it gets dark, and everyone's a bit like, everyone's wide-eyed, and, you know, we're going to be on the boat for the first time at night. And then it was like, what was it? You tell it best, where it was sort of like, everyone's needing a...
So basically, it's starting to get dark now. The adrenaline of leaving Portugal, Lagos in Portugal, is sort of dying off. And it's sort of about time we should be getting into a routine. And the routine for each individual was 2 hours on, 2 hours off. That was it. That was our routine. 2 hours rowing, 2 hours sleeping, 2 hours... and so on. Anyway, obviously, like Aldo just said, we had different responsibilities prior to leaving, and Ross's was tea, coffee. We call it a tea boat or a coffee boat, whatever you want to, you know, drinks. He's responsible for getting together a pack for drinks for the duration. Anyway, as the sun's setting and we're just losing sight of land, it was a, you know, group decision, right, let's get the hot wets on, let's get the hot drinks on. Ross Johnson went white and sort of went back into his cabin, scurried around for a little bit because we had two cabins that we shared, came back out, and he was like, lads, I've forgotten the tea, coffee and hot chocolate, to which he nearly got launched off the boat.
But that was
it
for
like
the
a
next...
mega sense of humour failure. But when you think about it, if you know, and the reason he forgot it was because he doesn't drink tea or coffee. So, oh, that's great. You're all right then. But what we had to, when you think about it, we drank plain, cold water for how many days?
2 months, 50 days.
Yeah, 50 days.
Yeah, 7 weeks. We had nothing else to put in the water. But I mean, the amount of planning that goes into those, I mean, that was one thing. Each of us, all of us had our own fuck-ups, can we swear?
Yeah.
There was so many things that could have gone wrong that they didn't, you know, all of us working as a team. And I actually love it. I look back to it and the songs that we were playing in the middle of the Atlantic, and you're just like, this is off the charts. But, you know, where we were coming down from Lagos, you've got the North Atlantic swelling weather, South Atlantic swelling weather, and then you've got all that African weather coming across. So
As soon as you get to Canaries, when you look on our tracker, it then starts getting a bit weird, doesn't it?
Things got weird.
Yeah, things got weird. But essentially, we started hitting rough sea. Do you remember? And we were sort of like powering along on these big waves, and we're going kind of in the right direction. And it was, you know, that force of the sea.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah, that it's, you know, with that wind and it's scary.
It was petrifying at times. You'd be in, like, it would be bright blue skies, but the seas, is, you know, it's windy, so the seas have whipped up. And I'm saying, you'd see waves everywhere. Just, it's own body of water moving.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Either side of you, you'd see a wave break, and it was like the size of two houses. And I remember having the discussion. Do you remember where we were at? How heavy is that wave? Like, how much water is in that? And what if that was us that was underneath that break? And then obviously we were under one
meter's a ton. There's loads. Basically, it's also similar to being at war. There's like 90% doing nothing, sat on your ass, and 10% being terrified at your wit's end and not knowing what's going to happen next. And everything that you planned for, because Foxy was late to the party, we basically got rid of all of our safety kit to get Foxy's food in for the full trip, because we didn't know how long it was going to take. So we're like, Foxy's a big lad, he's probably double duffing every minute. so we got rid of all that safety kit. And so the first bit, if I remember the chronology of it, the first bit we have a bit of a rough time and we chuck out para anchor and we get that out, and we spend two or three days.
The para anchor is like an anchor that's basically a parachute, and it catches water. So it's tied to the boat, it fills with water, and it acts like an anchor. It keeps you on station in a position. Now,
from
you will
drifting,
drift.
Yeah.
You will drift because it's not secured to anything, but it keeps you in.
In
an area,
yeah. And so the first thing, like, I suppose Foxy and I probably had the most experience of being on expeditions and sorting stuff out. So we got the para anchor out, and then so you're effectively like a cork just bobbing around in this fairly big sea, which was weird and quite scary. You know, I'm basically, Foxy and I are spooning each other for 2 days, two nights, with nothing to do. It got quite lonely. but that was like the first thing where I was just like, you know, we're a long way from home. There's no rescue. There could be rescue, but it's not going to be anytime soon. And that big sea at that time was when that other boat went over, and I think they lost.
Someone died. Yeah, we were in the vicinity of that, actually. There was a separate group that had disappeared. Not disappeared, but they'd set off from the Canaries. So we were in the vicinity of the Canaries, and this storm, this system came in. And then we got wind that they'd actually lost someone overboard and was never retrieved. So it was, you know, there was a few times when we were sat in that, laid in that cabin, spooning. Nothing weird happened, I'd just like to add. There was a couple of times when I was like, maybe we've bitten off a little bit more than we can chew here. And I don't know whether we might not get home. And anyway, the row's the row. Before we come off that subject, I just want you to, from your point of view, there's two stories I want you to talk about. One of them, the first one, is about my incident where I got angry. You know what I'm on about. Explain to people.
The shoes.
And me. Yeah. Go on, explain
so
that.
We basically, you know, that story's out there. We got capsized. So I'm doing the shoes right, and then
yeah.
So basically, we get capsized, and it's genuinely pretty bloody scary. Boat goes over, loads of stuff. It's at night, can't see anything. My shoes and bits and bobs, I lose them.
And just quickly, so like Aldo wasn't the first to lose his shoes. I think Ollie Bailey lost his trainers. So did Matt Bennett. And so when Aldo lost his, there was only two people left with their trainers, and it was a big deal. And it was a big deal.
Bear in mind, we had 4,500 miles to still row at that point.
And it's people might be thinking, well, you don't need your shoes; you're rowing it. You put your feet. If you've ever been on an erg rower, this is the old rowing machine in the gym. If you don't have shoes on, those straps, it's exactly the same footholds that you have. Those straps hurt.
Yeah, they rip your feet to bits.
Rip your feet to shreds anyway. So obviously, Aldo loses his trainers. There's only two of us left that have trainers.
So Ross Johnson decides that he's going to keep his trainers firmly on his feet for the next 50 days. Like, he doesn't take them off. At all, so he's,
we were actually worried about the time he did take them off, what it would be like. But anyway, that's a separate. That's a podcast on itself.
He didn't want to look at them because he didn't know how bad they were. So anyway, Foxy's as usual. Foxy and I are sharing the cabin, and like we're kind of like we've known each other for so long. We're like an old married couple, squabbling, bickering, but still sorting each other's admin out. Foxy comes off shift or whatever. I'm getting his toothbrush ready, and he's got toilet paper ready for me. And basically looking out for each other. But Foxy's got his admin, he's got his trainers, and he's got this carabiner on the back of his shoes holding them together. Foxy and I coming on shift together, so he's holding his trainers carabiner together in his hand, and he's walking down, and there's these rails that run down the side that Foxy was holding on to, and this big wave basically came into him, and he sort of pulled this sort of cable back, and then fired his shoes into the Atlantic on the biggest catapult that you've ever seen. Both shoes joined together, spinning round. Unlike mine, which were, you know, they're going to end up on two separate beaches. Foxy's were together, landed in the water. And I tell you what, I've known them for a long time, and will happily take the piss out of him at any point. I literally I could not stop laughing to myself, but I didn't. I gave it a full 24 hours before I started ripping him. He was so angry. I was like, if I give him any shit, he's going to throw me overboard.
I lost my shit in a big, big way.
Like a proper tantrum. Yeah. In fact, it was such a big tantrum, he threw his trainers out the pram.
And quickly, before we move off the row, probably the worst thing you had to do, what was it?
There was lots. Foxy over the I get to the end of the row almost, and I've had nothing wrong with me. Just bear this in mind when I tell this story. So Bailey gets something wrong with his foot. We all got these ingrowing hairs in the follicles with these huge abscesses, and I was dealing one with Ollie's foot, and they're getting infected, and I'm having to take antibiotics. And Foxy ends up having this pain in his bottom, which he asked me to have a look at. And bear in mind,
I need to jump in it. It's not just the pain; it was excruciating. I could not sit down, and we all found it hard to sit down because basically all the meat that you have in your arse had gone. Your body had consumed that for energy. And we all looked like we had the arses of frogs.
They sat on the long bones, aren't they?
Yeah, and you just sat on your bone, and it's like it got to the point where we were fashioning like they looked like the old piles cushions that people would need to use.
Space pretzel.
And we were making them out of old T-shirts and black masking tape. And if someone had fashioned a decent one, the others would try and nick it off him.
It becomes very tribal, doesn't it? You're like, that's my sheepskin.
I went to sit down one day on the rowing seat to get into position, and I literally nearly launched myself back up into space. It was horrific. The pain was unbearable, and I was like, mate, you're gonna have to have a look at this. So I then lie on my side.
Bear in mind, the cabin.
I get into like a fetal position on my side, and then with one hand, I pull my cheeks apart.
And bear in mind, the cabin is just enough to get Foxy in it, and me, if I'm like spooning him or vice versa, it's just big enough to get that. So the furthest I could get away from Foxy's crack in his ass was probably about 6 inches. Bear in mind, we're in Big C and he's lying on his side sort of pulling his ass apart. And my face and my nose is like about this far away from from his backside. And it turns out that, Foxy's got one of these ingrowing hairs right next to his bottom hole. What do you
hoop.
Right next to his hoop. He's got this like massive ingrowing boil from the hair, which we're all getting at that point. And ultimately that I spent the next sort of like week or so lancing this thing, getting rid of all the pus out of it, dressing it
twice a day.
Yeah,
morning and night.
Yeah, 3 days in, Foxy was wanting more of it. But the row is one of those things that looking back, like, I loved it. It was hard graft. There's nothing harder than get only the longest amount of time asleep you'll have in 24 hours. It's probably an hour and a half, and then you'll probably get two blocks of that. And it was one of the most amazing things that I've done. It's hard work, and I learned a lot about myself on that, actually, you know, considering I was probably, 38 when I did it, and learning new things about me and, like temper, anger issues, like there's all that sort of stuff. You know, everything's under a magnifying glass when you're five blokes the size of Foxy, stuck in a boat no bigger than this table. But yeah, we did it. 50 days, 10 hours.
And we are in the I'm going to say this because I'm proud of it. We're in the Guinness Book of Records, and we'll never leave that because we set that record.
Yeah.
So there we go. Away from the Atlantic, mate. It is all really about you. You've forged an amazing career in TV, predominantly doing safety, and you've had my back on the Inside the Real Narcos.
Yeah,
we worked together on that for a long time, but the shoot probably was all up 3 months.
Yep.
can you describe the sort of things that you do with the film crews and what sort of exciting weird scrapes you've been in? I mean, you've worked with Steve Backshall on some awesome TV.
Yeah,
I've been lucky enough to have you on the Narcos shoot.
It feels like, it's probably the best job in the world for me. It's if you'd spoken to me when I was 16 and said this is what I'll be doing, that's exactly what I wanted to be doing. I didn't know it was television, but it's like boys on adventure, flying around the world, going off and jumping into volcanoes or, into jungles. Just like proper commando comic magazines, that sort of stuff. But like, for as much as you're in front of camera and you've done your time behind camera as well with the diving Captain Kidd stuff that we did, and it, for as much as you're on camera now and some of the on-camera stuff that Steve and I do on expeditions, there is a huge amount of work that goes on in the background. It's the production companies, it's the camera guys, it's the sound guys, it's the tech guys. And you look at, Steve and I have done 10, ta-da, Steve and I have done 10 expeditions.
They're here now, working hard.
Yeah. Steve and I have done 10, 12 expeditions in the last couple of years to the most remote, far-flung corners on the planet. And Steve's doing his thing and I'm sort of looking after the crew, making sure they're safe. But you've got like a camera guy who's shooting and the producers, everyone's shooting, recording film. And when we finish our day, they're just starting because they've got to do all the data downloads. They've got to be making sure all their cards are clean for the next day's shooting. And they're doing it, they're not doing it sort of sat in a hotel room. They're in a jungle, they're in a cave, they're up a tree. They're in some of the sort of the most remote places on Earth.
What's that sound?
That's a bottle of water.
And so my job really has always been in television, is looking after film crews from a technical level of whether it's diving, whether it's ropes, climbing, safety. And it's the same as you guys. When you're working, you're not paying attention, obviously.
Mark, who's essentially our supervisor boss, is on his phone not giving two shits about what we're talking about.
But the crew, like in Narcos, so Fox and I, we go down and we're in South America, Colombia, Peru and Mexico, and you're filming and interviewing some pretty heavy characters that are involved in drugs, cartels, hitmen. And essentially what the crew are there filming as well, and their heads are, they're separated because the heads in in the camera or in the sound gear or in the story, so they're not really paying attention.
They lose their situational awareness, don't they?
Exactly. Yeah. So really, I mean, my job is just a glorified sort of bag handler and looking after it, just making sure all the pieces sort of fall into place. And it's just that, it's that step back situational awareness, isn't it? And so, that can be anywhere from expeditions with Steve Backshaw or working with Ed Stafford out in the mangrove swamps or yourself and doing the sort of Narcos stuff. I mean, it's varied and amazing working out. I do feel super lucky to be doing it.
On just a little story from Narcos, Inside the Real Narcos. Me and Aldo have known each other a long time. We get on, and there's very rarely been any times where we've fallen out, to be fair, if I'm honest. You know, even being on that boat, when Aldo, you know, he's a Scotsman, he doesn't like the sun. He used to lose his shit sometimes when it got too hot. But Inside the Real Narcos, we did have a little mini falling out, didn't we? Just prior to a very sketchy situation.
We'd already been out to wear an Acapulco, and we'd been out. I mean, it's a dire situation to even be, I suppose, not joking about. But it shows you the level that we were at. And we were fairly wrung out through that whole Narcos thing, Inside the Real Narcos. And we're, Foxy and I are working together. We've got a camera and a director there, but it's still just us on the ground. There's no cavalry. There's no one coming in to save you when it all goes tits up. And, and we'd had a bit of a, we'd have a little bit of a falling out. We'd been working up in the sort of, it wasn't in the morgue, wasn't it? In the forensics department. And we had a bit of a falling out.
Fell out over a bloody cigarette. You know, we don't smoke, but when you're in stressful situations, we were like, oh, right, we're having a cigarette. And I can't remember exactly what it was about, but we fell out.
I can't remember. It was either there was none left, he had it, or I had it. I can't remember what it was. Anyway. So we got called out to this situation where there's basically a guy getting sort of emptied out a bag. I mean, it was a narco.
It was horrific, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, I think what Foxy was getting at there is, like, when you're that much mates and you have that sense of humour, I mean, that kind of all just paled into insignificance because I was pissed off with him or he was pissed off with me. And
I was actually trying to, like, get through the tension between us because we'd fallen out. We'd had a little bit of a sort of tete-a-tete, we'd argued with each other. And then there was this horrific situation unfolding and I turned around trying to talk to Aldo and he was literally just ignoring me, point blank, looking away over his shoulder.
not help.
Refusing to talk. And I was like, I'm on my own. Yeah. Anyway.
That's my job is about people. My job is always about people. It's about forging relationships. It's about everything that we, in the military, you learn a lot about, having force behind you, using weapons. We go into sort of narco land where we do all the stuff that we do and where you're dealing with nature, rhinos when we were sort of charged down in South Africa doing the Veterans for Wildlife stuff. You then enter into this completely different skill set, which I'm still learning about, is about talking your way out of trouble as opposed to using force, and interpersonal skills and emotional intelligence and all this other, I guess, buzzwords, isn't it?
That
make a difference.
Not that emotional intelligence did us any favours with that rhino that charged us where my arse fell out, literally. Staying on the subject of crazy stuff, erupting volcanoes. Yeah, this seems, you've seemed to have carved yourself a niche here now, but if I'm honest, because you are the go-to jump in a volcano guy. If someone wants to film a load of lava, they phone you up, don't they?
Yeah, well, I don't know. It was actually the first job that I ever did in television. And I was asked by a friend who ran a safety company if I could get them I was asked by a mate who ran a safety company if I could get a BBC team inside an active volcano. And I just left the Marines and, I was fairly cocksure of what I could do. And I was like, yeah, of course I can. And it's in the Congo and, it's the biggest lava lake on earth. And all that pales into insignificance. I sold it. I could do it. I was a ropes dude. Had a military background, I was going to nail it. And so I took a team out there.
We're always operating in volcanoes.
Yeah, me? I've always worked in volcanoes. So anyway, I remember going out there, and it's the first time I've been absolutely blown away by
the power of the earth and nature, and that, you know, sounds fairly weird. I got to the top of the volcano in Virunga National Park. I've got 100 bags arriving there. I've got a film crew arriving there. I'm working for a mate who's, you know, pretty much relying on me to get this film crew inside there. And I remember walking to the top of the volcano and thinking, you absolute dick, you've bitten off more than you can chew. I had to walk off away from the crew that were there, because I was just like, I have no idea how to...
I'm interested in that. What did you... When you walked away from the crew, because we, you know, we do focus on resilience and how you get through tough times. What was that chat that you had with yourself?
I was basically scared, very scared, in a sort of in a guttural way that felt like, you know, when you're in, you know, when you see and you're inside a volcano which is active, it's one of, you know, it's one of the most humbling, weird experiences, because it can snuff you out in a nanosecond, yeah, with gas, with, you know, with eruptions, with lava. And I knew nothing about volcanoes. We had volcanologists there, but, you know, I knew nothing about it. So I walked off. It was because A, I was scared. B, I was annoyed with myself for being so confident. Above,
a bit brazen about the
brazen
whole.
About what the actual risks were, and I had a team there that I was now responsible for, and there was a lot of pressure. There was a lot of money. We had, you know, it was probably a couple of hundred grand to get a full film crew out there to do this shoot and high profile. So I took myself off, and it's the same as everything now. I mean, we chat about this. Mm. When you're faced with something that seems insurmountable, it's easy to talk yourself out of it and talk yourself, you know, into that insidious voice inside your head, which tells you you're not good enough and you can't do it. And so what I did, I walked off, had a mild panic, started to breathe. Breathing sorts most things out, and it sounds really stupid. And that goes back to, like,
true,
sniper course. Just if you can collectively sort your breathing out, a lot of other things fall into place. Sorted my breathing out and then went through the individual steps of, right, it's a massive project, but okay, so today I just need to make sure all the bags and I'll keep going until I get found out, but make sure all the bags are neat here. Tomorrow I'll abseil down a bit and I'll get the feel of it, and then so you break that massive goal down into manageable chunks, and then that confidence comes back once you can start to do little bit. But I tell you, man, I got to the top of that and I was scared, annoyed at myself and angry at myself for sort of feeling like I could do it.
But mate, that's the first time we've properly spoken about that. Mm. I know we talk about stuff and we, yeah, you know, but that's a great story. But the point is, you might have been angry at yourself, but you have, in life, I believe, you have to take those leaps of faith. And that's, yeah, a leap of faith that you took. And you became comfortable in an uncomfortable situation. And that's where you grow as an individual, I think.
Yeah,
you
know it's 100%.
I know that sounds like me preaching, but...
No, you know, when I jumped... Actually, after about 4 days, I'd rigged out nearly 2 kilometres of rope on my own, yeah, inside the volcano. And then you then get into that zone where, you know, there's rocks falling down near you, it's erupting, you're on your own, your gas monitor's going off, and you just deal with the stuff. But it's that being stretched out your comfort zone. And I suppose, I think the big thing is working out when you're in panic mode, how to rectify that. Because ultimately, since then, I've been back inside that volcano 3 times. We've done it safely every time. We've not even had a twisted ankle, and it erupted when we're inside there once. You know, we've done a lot of man hours and shifting kit inside there, but yeah, it was a complete wind your neck in, Aldo, and make sure you focus back in on the basics, which is pretty much, you know, what I have to do all the time on jobs is basics. If you do the basics right, then everything else falls into place.
Yeah. Moving away from the excitement of volcanoes, I think the best thing to do now is talk to you about something that we've joked about in the past, since you've done it. Is not as dangerous, But it's just as interesting is when you were tasked, I think, again by the BBC to scurry away into a bunker for 10 days with no daylight.
Yeah, the it was a BBC Horizon doc. And they,
this was a no-brainer for me. Basically, the things we joke about, I was like, I'll tell you what he's going to do, and we can't talk about that.
I can easily whittle away 10 days. It was a BBC Horizon doc on circadian rhythms, sleep patterns, jet lag, how that affects people. And I didn't...
Circadian rhythms, explain.
So circadian rhythm is not just your rhythm of sleep, when you go to sleep, when you wake up, what your sleep pattern is throughout your sleep cycle. It's also each of your internal organs has its own circadian rhythm based on a 24-hour, roughly. So a circadian... I'm not a scientist, obviously, and I can't remember exactly the format, but... In a 24-hour period, you sleep for a bit, and then you're awake for a bit, and then that runs like
and
that.
And everything inside you does the same thing.
Yeah, so your
organs need to know when to do that.
Yeah, your stomach, and from what they told me before I went into the bunker was that that you've basically got 24 hours. Your body's reset by daylight every day, and so that being reset by daylight, you live in this 24-hour world which we've manufactured. But mm-hmm. your circadian rhythm is actually anything between 24 and 26 hours. So when you cut someone off from time and daylight and they're in the darkness, they then go into, I guess, like free fall. So you might be adding 50 minutes on to your day every day. So you go to bed at 2 o'clock, the next day it's 2:40, the next day it's 3:20.
So in just quickly, whilst you were in that bunker.
Yeah.
Down deepest, darkest southwest of England.
Yeah.
You didn't have any idea of time. You didn't have a stopwatch. You didn't. No. So you couldn't, like,
so they,
at least say, right, I'm going to do a 20-minute workout.
No.
You didn't really know.
You never. So this is the interesting thing. Like, some of the stuff that I've taken away from it have genuinely helped me, which is weird. And, you know, everyone should do time in a bunker. These are the things, right? So you're underground, so there's no sound. It's in a soundproof room. The sound of silence is deafening.
Yeah,
it is, like, debilitatingly deafening. And I've, you know, that's the first time I've truly heard it. Silence.
You had no music.
No. So they walk me down. It's like three flights of stairs under the ground. They put me in a room. They lock it. It's dark. They've got little lights because they're filming, but it's, I don't know, 10 watt bulbs. You can't do it. You can't see. It's like...
You basically got tortured by the BBC.
But what was amazing is they take all the tech off you. There's no contact with the outside world at all. There's no clocks. There's no time. So interestingly, if you get your head down at home, you know what time you go to bed and you wake up on an alarm. Roughly your circadian rhythm sorts you out, right? So you know that you've been asleep for 5 hours. When you go into the bunker... And you get your head down and you wake up, you have no idea what time you went to bed and what time you woke up. So you don't know how long you've been asleep. So it could be 2 hours, it could be four, it could be eight, it could be 10. And then so you've got 10 days of this cycle. And actually, so you can't count days because you don't know when it's daylight or dark. And so what you have to do is then, you know, I drew 10 boxes on the wall with a pen, and I just, it's like being in, well, it was solitary confinement. And so I was every sleep cycle, I would then sort of mark off what I thought was a day. And I would try and, you know, so we did, you do this sort of trips prone to capture course, don't you? And they'd sort of teach you about keeping your mind busy and how to split up your days and split up your time. And so I was sort of like writing out a timetable on the wall about, you know, I had to do phys at this time, or not this time because you don't have time, but you got to do phys for about an hour.
Phys is PT.
Yeah, you got to do exercise for about an hour, and it's in the dark. So I'm like doing burpees in the dark and, you know, press ups. And it's, you know, it's depressing. It's like distilling everything about training and everything I hate about it. You know, it's just like all I'm doing is going up and down in the dark. Like, what's the point? But 10 days rambling on, 10 days in the dark, on your own, no time, no people, no comms, no noise, nothing, was like a complete reset. The film was about circadian rhythms, which I wasn't massively interested in. By the end of it, I was much more interested in mental health and what that
meant to me and what that means to, when, you know, when I talk to people that say they have an issues with sort of mental health. And it seems like if you're not getting enough daylight and you're not getting enough exercise and you're not having enough social interaction with people, it seems like, to me anyway, it's not a long section of time before you could find yourself with some fairly traumatic either stress, anxiety or depression.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough that I knew it was 10 days because I had to come out and fly to Greenland on day 10. So to 24-hour daylight, which was a complete head fuck. But inside the bunker, I came out with this new sort of appreciation of how much and how vital exercise, daylight and human interaction is to good mental health. So it was, for me, it was much more about that than the sleep.
It was fascinating. When he told me he was doing it, I was like, what the fuck? And then actually, if he thinks he was like, I get annoyed if I send Aldo a text message or a WhatsApp and he doesn't reply reasonably quickly.
Yeah.
And then that was probably a longer 10 days than it was for him, because I was like, I can't pester him. It's like,
the funny part of it was, I was in there, no relationship to time whatsoever. They then come down and get me on day 10. I'm already starting to panic and unwind because I think I've made the wrong calculation. Maybe I'm on day 9. They come down, get me, come out, we do an interview. Then they stick me in the car with the researcher. She drives me down to the station and I'm still, it's like the Matrix. I can smell every single plant that I'm driving past. And like you can see, it's like all these scents and smells and, you know, it's like the Matrix. And get to the train station and I'm still, I've got my sunglasses on because I can hardly see. And I'm running up the stairs to get the train. And just as I get there, the guy's like, blows the whistle. And I was like, you've still got a minute and a half. And he's like, because I'd just been given my watch back. And he's like, no, mate, you just missed it. Sorry, train pulls off. And I'm like, no, I've had 10 days of not being slave to time or man. And then I missed the train by 1 minute. And then I have to pay £200 to get back to London in a taxi.
Jesus, that's an amazing story, mate. And cheers, one, dude. We've not really spoken
about. No, we haven't.
I'm happy about that. Mate, moving away from 10 days in a bunker, which isn't that scary, but it can be, sort of petrifying in a different way. Real quickly, you deal with fear on a pretty much a daily basis. How do you manage it?
Managing fear has always been a difficult one for me. I'll try and keep it short. But initially, when I was first doing stuff in the military, you know, where they make you, like, I don't know, in the Marines, in training, you're constantly doing things which progressively scaring you a bit more, like dunker drills in the helicopter, you're under the water.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose over the years, I've just got used to listening to people who know what they're talking about and doing exactly what they say. But when it comes to dealing with environmental factors like exploding volcanoes, rockfall, wild animals, I always feel like, up until recently, I always felt like, you know, when you get that adrenaline buzz and you're like, that was fear.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, getting to realize more that that's actually sort of like body getting ready to then help me lift, run, fight, do whatever I need to do. So the way I deal with fear is I actually break it down and try and step back from it and look, am I right to be scared? Because there are times on Narcos, for example, inside the real Narcos, that we were right to be scared. Mm. And that fear allows you to then take action, you know, to get you out of that situation. So I always, first of all, look at it, assess it. Is it something that I need to be worried about? Is it something that I've trained for? Is it something that's subjective, objective, whatever? And then it's my job to mitigate as many of these risks as possible. So once I've sorted as many of the risks out, as I can, then the rest of it potentially is down to luck, training, and keeping your shit wild when everyone else is losing theirs round about you. And if you are genuinely scared, just find a job to do, find someone else that you can focus your attention on and sort them out, and then that takes your mind off it.
Sweet, happy days. Basically, use fear to focus.
Yeah.
Lastly, mate, always ask a question at the end. What works for you in terms of looking after yourself mentally and physically? What do you do?
Cool. So basically my job is all about me being functionally fit. Don't need abs, don't need big arms, don't need as much as I'd like them. I don't need excess weight. So for me, to be honest, like for me, mental health is much more important and prevalent than physical health, because if I've got good mental health from being outside, from working outside, from that feeling of purpose of being after something, whether it's a job, whether it's, you know, a goal, whatever it is, that mental health and that feeling good in my head then allows me to train. If I'm not feeling good, like if I've been at home for 2 months and I've got no jobs coming in, and insidious voice starts sort of taking away in your head about how good you are. Are you that good in the first place? Who even are you? Then fizz goes out the window. So my training goes out the window. So, you know, for me to keep in good physical shape, to be functionally fit for my work, I need to keep my head in good order, first of all. And that, you know, it's like meeting mates. It's, you know, going for a beer. It's training. You know, it's like it's being outside. It's all that stuff.
Getting outdoors into the wild.
Get outside. I mean, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, from doing the Yukon, like as soon time outside is seldom wasted. You know, it's words to live by.
Agreed, mate. That was awesome. I mean, we've spoken about stuff we've never spoken about, which is an amazing thing, and we should probably do this more often. But we just end up going to the pub and getting a little bit drunk and having a great time. But anyway, thank you very much.
Mate. Yeah, thank you for having us on. Mega.
Thanks very much to Aldo, and I hope you enjoyed the chat. Really appreciate you listening, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and follow me and the Book of Man for the latest news. Thanks to Talisker for sponsoring, and make sure you follow them too. Cheers.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.